It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tye. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us today. While Western medicine has become better at diagnosing, treating, and even curing disease, its counterparts in other medical traditions often still outpace it in treating the whole patient. In other words, the consideration of a patient's mental, emotional, and even spiritual health can play a huge role in a successful treatment plan. One of the pioneers in the movement to integrate spirituality into healthcare is Dr. Christina Pahalsky. She's the founder and director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health at GW University in Washington, D.C. She's board certified in internal medicine and palliative care, but also has a degree in social work. She tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North what she's getting at when she talks about integrating spirituality in medicine.
We're talking about a more holistic system of care, a more whole person focus on care, where the inner life of the person is integrated into the total care of that patient. So when we define spirituality, it's really about how people find a sense of deep meaning and purpose in their life and how they experience a connectedness to a variety of things. It may be, if people are religious, it may be God. It may be family. It may be nature. It may be the moment. It may be the inner self, or what we've defined in a consensus conference as the significant or sacred. So it's really understanding that that inner part of a person's life is crucial to their health care. And a lot of data actually has shown that spirituality, broadly defined, as well as religion more specifically defined, can impact health care outcomes, can impact the way people cope. And when you're talking about illness and when you're talking about wellness, you know, we talk about the mind, body, spirit. And oftentimes the spiritual part is neglected. People talk about exercising, healthy eating, maybe even some emotional health. But rarely do people think about spiritual wellness, which would be, are we finding meaning in our lives? Do we live a life that is in accordance with our aspirations? Or are we just kind of carrying on through life and surviving, as opposed to finding that really deep sense of enthusiasm and purpose?
So as a medical professional, how do you find out what that is? And then how do you incorporate whatever you find into your care plan?
The first step is recognizing that a relationship is really important, and that as a physician, as a clinician, we're not just asking questions to quickly process people through a system.
Although a lot of people would feel that is exactly what's
happening. Oh, I
know
a lot of people feel that way, sadly. But we are really having a conversation with that patient. And in that conversation, of course, we're asking questions that might help us elucidate or figure out what the diagnosis is, for sure. So we have very specific targeted questions. But at the same time, we have to establish a relationship. We have to establish a connection. That person needs to trust us, and we have to work hard to earn that trust. So all of that is part of spirituality. Even before you start asking the question, it's the minute you walk into the patient's room, whether it's the patient alone or the patient and family, you sit down and you begin a relationship. And you earn that trust, and then you move forward with the kinds of questions you need to ask in order to help them. And part of those questions then becomes not just about their physical life, but about their psychosocial and spiritual life as well. So tell me a little bit about yourself. What are your relationships like? Do you have support in those relationships? Do you generally feel well? Are you depressed? Are you anxious? And then what about your work? Do you work? And how do you take care of yourself? I know, do you exercise well? Do you eat well? And what about your spirituality? Tell me a little bit more about that. That's the conversation where you're really, we call it the social history or the personal history, but it's that part of the intake where we're really trying to get to know what matters most to that patient. Some people say, well, you can just say what matters most. Well, what I've found in my own experience, and many clinicians will tell you this, that in a clinical environment where there's a lot of pressure with time and, as I said, you know, trying not to push people through, it's very important to have targeted questions that also have some evidence base from the medical perspective. Now, doctors in general and even nurses won't be asking questions unless they know that it's really something that is going to impact that person's care. So there is a lot of data that spirituality, asking questions about emotions as well, but all of that, that actually can impact the care of the whole person. So if I am listening to a person's story about their spirituality and I find out, for example, that they In fact, this is a true story. It's I'm going to modify it a little bit, but a patient from a couple of weeks ago comes and tells me that she's thinking about assisted suicide. Oh, that's a pretty heavy question.
It sure is.
You know, and to then say, well, tell me a little bit more about your what you're thinking about it and why you're thinking about it. And then it ends up being that that person, you know, feels they have no meaning in their life, that their life is done. They have nothing more to do.
So what do you
That's spirituality.
So what do you do as a clinician in that instance when somebody presents something like that to you and you think, wow, this person doesn't feel that they have any meaning? Do you help them find it? Is that appropriate? To kind of guide them to look in other ways or other places?
It would be very easy if one could write a prescription for here.
Yeah.
This
here.
Will fix it.
Feel better. Yeah.
So the first thing I do, or the first thing we should do is listen and really, really listen intently without trying to fix it. Many times, whether it's that kind of a question or I'm just really down or you know, my mother just died or, you know, my pet is dying or I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. Many times if we're trying to push people along, the kind of conversation is truncated. You know, get to the point really quickly and tell me. Now, instead, we need a different kind of a focus. And the focus is to sit back and listen really intently. You know, really look at the person, really care for them deeply and provide an environment where they can really feel that they can share that without judgment. So anything, it doesn't have to be as dramatic as, you know, assisted suicide. It can be anything that you want to provide that environment where people can first start talking. As you're listening to the story, you may be able to hear some themes. You may be able to use what we call reflective questioning. Tell me a little more about that. Or have you ever thought about this? To help that person go deeper in their story. Never should one say, I have a good answer for you. Why don't you go to this church? Or why don't you take up this activity? You know, you want to listen first. A chaplain colleague of mine, George Hanzo, who's done a lot of work with us, as we with him, he's at Healthcare Chaplaincy in New York. He said about 90% of the time, just really listening deeply with compassion to a person's story, that person will start to find answers for themselves. They won't walk out of my office with an answer. You know, these are very heavy questions. But at least in the conversation, they might be able to, number one, feel heard. That might make them feel better. But they might be able to start thinking of things and saying, well, maybe I still do have some meaning, you know. Maybe I'll check this out. Sometimes you can refer. So if I start hearing a story and in that I think the person is seriously depressed, as well as spiritual distress, there's also depression. Well, who else on the team can I bring in? So I start thinking about counseling and offer those as suggestions or a psychiatrist. If I hear that there's a lot of social isolation and maybe that's really where this spiritual distress is coming from, well, then I might ask some more questions about the social environment. And maybe offer some resources there. Usually for very severe spiritual distress, I try to refer to a trained chaplain. So that's generally how someone would handle that.
It seems to me that what we're talking about is having the time to be able to do exactly that. And we come back to the right. to the medical model that we're all living in, which is that there is very little time for people with incredibly good intentions like yourself and a team that's trying to treat each person as an individual. Are we really looking at needing to fix a medical system to incorporate this?
So part of me wants to say to you right now that's a bit of an excuse.
Yeah.
Number one.
Okay.
And yes, we're trying to fix the system. So just two answers. I mean, one is that we are also creative individuals. So, you know, in my practice, and I do run behind, I have to admit. So people who want, you know, very mechanistic things usually don't choose someone like me as a physician. But if I find that something evolved in the story and that person needs more attention and they're not – so it's not that it's such severe depression that they have to go to the emergency room, for example, but they need more attention. So I will get to a point where I think they feel reasonably safe and I'll say, don't leave the room, and I'll go and see the other patient and then I come back. Or I will sometimes give my cell phone to my patients and try to at least ensure that we've brought the visit to a bit of a closure, that the person's safe to leave or okay to leave. But I ensure a follow-up. And if they need to call me that evening or I call them, can I call you this evening? It doesn't have to be a lengthy call. I think many times people just feel so lonely and disconnected. And if they really see true care, not sort of, you know, I really care about you and I'll be there, you know, but I really do care about you and I really will be there. And here's my number. Or I would like to call you tonight. It's 7 o'clock, okay, just to check in. you know, if they see that, oftentimes that's like a, you know, if you're drowning, that's like the lifesaver that gets thrown out, you know, something that they can hold on to while they're trying to figure out what to do. Part of the system that is good is more of a team-based approach. Fortunately, where I work in the geriatrics and palliative care division, we do have a social worker. So I can try to ask some of my colleagues to help out. I can call my colleagues. I'm in a huge practice, so I can try to call someone, psychiatry or someone, a chaplain. I really think this person would benefit seeing you. Making that connection, setting up an appointment. You can bring someone back a little earlier than 3-6 months or whatever. There are many ways that you can do that. So time is real. It's not just an excuse. But to care and be compassionate is not dependent on time. It's intentional. Okay. So you walk into that room, I'm going to be there for you. Do we need a system change? I think we need a huge alert to policymakers, insurances, and other entities that are trying to evolve the healthcare system into a sort of a next phase. And that is that unless we value the relationship between the physician and the patient, the nurse and the patient, another clinician and the patient, unless we say that is of number one importance and we're going to invest in that, we're just going to keep going downhill. We're going to get patients that haven't had their needs met. They're going to end up in the ER, in urgent care, high utilization of costs elsewhere, also with their needs not being met because those aren't appropriate places for that. And, you know, we're just going to keep spiraling downhill. And worst of all, our patients' suffering will not be attended to.
We'll talk a little bit about some of the statistics that you mentioned earlier in our conversation that have shown that this kind of attention being paid actually affects outcomes in a positive way.
So first of all, there's many studies that show, if we're just talking about spirituality for a minute, many surveys that have shown that patients want their physicians to address their spirituality and integrate it in their care. Many studies. Looking at cancer patients, newly diagnosed cancer patients have very high levels of spiritual distress, as you can imagine. And for certain people who are diagnosed with dementia, other serious illnesses, very high levels of spiritual distress. What's going to happen to me? Why me? Why now? What's my future hold? Deep, deep sense of hopelessness. And those types of distress, that spiritual distress, can impact symptoms. So high spiritual distress can result in increased pain and difficulty in pain management, for example. So many of the studies suggest that spirituality is going to impact patient care outcomes. So therefore, our ability to attend to and treat spiritual distress is going to result in better quality of life for patients. Many studies looking particularly in palliative care, patients who have a sense of meaning and purpose and a sense of fulfillment in their life goals have much better quality of life, lower pain than patients who do not. So our ability to intervene with that as clinicians would be really important, again, for patient care outcomes. On another side, which is more the business side, but for many years we've known the studies about physicians who are sued. Physicians who have a relationship with their patients, who care about their patients, who are honest, who apologize, who make corrective changes are less likely to be sued than other types of physicians. So even at that level. And then there's a little bit of data that we have in our outpatient clinic that by being able to address with an interdisciplinary team, the doctors, chaplains, et cetera, by being able to address some of those issues, patients are more satisfied with their care and less likely to end up in urgent care and in ERs because they've had their needs addressed fully in a visit with the team. So the upfront investment of time and empowering the clinicians to have time to focus on the relationship and empowering patients in their own care, that upfront investment will save costs down the line. Readmissions, early discharges. Again, not all the needs were addressed. And I'm not only talking about spiritual, but psychosocial as well. Discharging an elderly, frail person who is not at all connected back into their environment where they're alone is almost a guarantee they're going to, quote, bounce back into the hospital. So the more we can invest in that hospital, in that whole person care, the less likely we are that that person's going to bounce back, the more likely we are that that person's going to have a better outcome and better quality of life.
So we're talking both health in terms of the whole person, but we're also talking about monetary outcomes as well, better utilization of funds and resources.
Right. And when we look at money, you know, as a bottom line, it's not just that sort of the immediate cost. That's what I'm saying about an investment up front. So you may need to, for example, put more money up front into having a good interdisciplinary team, into the focus on the relationship, into recognizing that, quote, the phrase I hate most is any provider does. That's not true. You know, patients form alliances and deep connections with their physicians or maybe the nurse practitioner or other people on the team. So recognizing the value of having consistency in the primary care, again, investing in primary care physicians, recognizing the value in that relationship and maybe putting more money up front to that, because down the line you are going to save costs, as I mentioned. People will be more satisfied with the care. They're more likely to recommend other patients to that kind of a clinical setting. So, you know, cost is complicated.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I'm not a business person, but I've had the pleasure of working with some of our business school colleagues in being able to recognize that they understand the full dimension of determining the bottom line. Again, it's not just pure cost savings. It's when you look at the whole picture.
How do you translate that into medical schools and training the next generation of physicians?
In 1992, I started a course on spirituality and health at George Washington University Medical School, which later became an award program generously funded by the Templeton Foundation. So we moved from a couple schools to like the majority of medical schools having topics related to spirituality. And all along, I've had people say, well, how can you teach your students to address spirituality if they haven't looked at that in their own life? So this has been in the back of my head as we're evolving this, you know, over the next 20-some years. And in 2009, we've developed some, competency standards around spirituality and health education. And in this consensus conference, almost 100% of the people said, we have to do something about the professional formation of our students. So professional formation traditionally has been more the intellectual building knowledge and skills, a little bit about ethical behavior, but rarely about students' own inner growth. Certainly not when I went to med school, that wasn't a focus. So we've now moved into, and at GW in our new curriculum, we talk about two paths for formations of students. One path is what I just mentioned. The other is the inner life or the spiritual life or the personal life of the student. And for that, we've developed something called Jewish Templeton Reflection Rounds, which we're now piloting in 10 schools. We did already in 8 schools. So we have 18 schools that are doing reflection rounds that are co-led by a trained chaplain and a physician. And the whole purpose of reflection rounds is for students to reflect on their relationship with their patient, how it affected them emotionally, how it affected them personally, what did they learn from that, how might that impact their future care. And the themes that we hear from our initial studies, it made me aware of the reason that I became a doctor or I'm becoming a doctor. It brought me back to my call. It made me realize that all these hoops I'm jumping through, they're fine, but the root of it is I want to serve others. Very much my spirituality, my values, my beliefs, that's what's driving me. That's why I went to medical school, and I don't want to lose that. You know, we want to meet more often. So they do. Sometimes even after the rounds end, the students just end up meeting to talk about these things. So we're beginning to start looking at ourselves, too. We're going to start a faculty group that does this as well. So that's where we've really moved in education to look at the inner life of ourselves, our students, and how that can be nurtured.
It sounds like good changes all the way around for everyone.
Yeah, we're trying.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you, Christina. I can't thank you enough for stopping by this morning.
Well, thank you. I have really enjoyed this conversation.
Dr. Christina Pahalski is director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health at GW University in Washington, D.C., and an internal medicine and palliative care doctor. She's also author of numerous books and articles on the topic. She spoke with Bonnie North while she was in Milwaukee to give the Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Coming up next, maybe a little analogy for you. Spirituality is to medicine as following the recipe is to pickling. We'll find out the life and death details about the homemade dills in your fridge when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.